commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is the Contracting Experience. Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
This podcast episode and the mention or appearance of external links does not constitute or imply official endorsement on behalf of the U.S. Department of the Air Force or Department of Defense. The Department of the Air Force does not endorse any non-federal entities, companies, products, or services. Moreover, the Department of the Air Force does not exercise any responsibility or oversight of the content at external link destinations mentioned during this podcast. The views expressed within this podcast are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we sit down with Mr. Tom Wells, a retired member of the Senior Executive Service who has over 35 years of Air Force acquisition-related experience and has held such esteemed positions as the Director of Contracting for Air Force Material Command, as well as the Director of the 711th Human Performance Wing. Mr. Wells has remained active in the government acquisition arena and currently serves as Vice President and Senior Associate at Dayton Aerospace, where he provides senior-level support and delivers acquisition training for both government and industry acquisition professionals. Mr. Wells comes to us today to share his experiences and insights over the years and to walk us through his 12 enduring principles for contracting professionals that remain as true today as when he first wrote them 30 years ago. Welcome, Mr. Tom Wells. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here with you. I hadn't put that together. It's 30 years. That was a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. 1995. All right. So, yeah, I'm excited to dive in and walk through each of these 12 enduring principles. And as you mentioned in your May 2021 article of Contract Management Magazine, some of these principles were learned the hard way, right, through challenges and mistakes. So that's really a lot of times where the real learning happens. And I'm hoping maybe you can share some of those war stories with us today as we go through. So let's jump right into your first principle. Principle number one, never forget the requirement. It is our reason for being. You mentioned that focusing on the requirement prevents us from getting bogged down in administrivia or non-consequential issues. Can you elaborate on how keeping the requirement front and center helps us avoid those pitfalls both before and after award?
It makes me think back to when I was at Hill Air Force Base. Deidre Lee, or D. Lee, was my supervisor back there in 1985. She went on to be the senior procurement executive at both NASA and the General Services Administration. And she used the phrase, "We got to keep our eye on the ball. We got to remember why we're doing this." And I think too often we get distracted by the things that have to be done rather than focusing on what is the result we're trying to deliver. When is it needed? How urgently is it needed? And making sure that that's our number one focus. And I'm afraid we just kind of, today, particularly, it seems we're even more caught up about the risk of compliance. And so we worry about all the rules and regulations. It used to take DOD, on average, about 8 years from the requirements to the delivery of first capability for a major systems acquisition. Over the last decade, that's increased to over 11 years. And so that's not going to win the future wars. And so from particularly from the DOD perspective, that focus on speed and delivering to the need is essential. And that's why I'm excited about this new executive order, modernizing defense acquisition and spurring innovation in the industrial base. We need to embrace speed, agility, and innovation to get these requirements fielded as quickly as possible. Our adversaries are taking risk, and they're moving fast, and we just can't afford to lag behind. And so, you know, while we have to do all this stuff, we have to, you know, have a good source selection plan. We have to write all these details in a contract and everything. All of what we do when we do all that detailed work should be focused on what does it do to get us our requirement and to get us our requirement quickly. Like, you know, focusing our source selection evaluation factors on key discriminators so that it's a quick and fast source selection decision that we can reduce our procurement lead time. And I think if we really make that the requirement, the primary focus, we can figure out a way to get it done faster.
No, excellent stuff, sir. That makes absolute perfect sense. Yeah, clarity and focus from the outset, absolutely crucial. So building on that, your second principle addresses an important aspect of defining and communicating those requirements. So principle number two, it is okay to discuss our requirements with industry, but you must be fair to all potential offerors. So I know this one has some history to it with maybe some misperceptions along the way, which maybe you can share. But from a practical standpoint, what's the biggest benefit gained from a robust pre-solicitation dialogue with industry? And how do we ensure fairness to all potential offerors in that process?
So the biggest requirement is a biggest benefit. It's a hard one because there's two big ones. One is getting our requirements right, something that the market can respond to. So that's essential. As we go out and we go out with draft RFPs or industry days, you get feedback from industry that helps us maybe tweak or modify our requirements so that we can take advantage of commercial items or non-developmental items. That will help with the whole speed that I'm really focused on today. The other side of it is it's useful for industry. I mean, if we have drafts going out and having dialogue happening, industry can begin to think about the requirement and begin to work on their proposal and maybe even make investments. I'll tell you a story for that one. When the Air Force thought or knew they needed a new trainer aircraft, they had no budget, but the T-43 was so old, they had to do something. They didn't have something they could train for kind of fifth gen F-35 kind of aircraft performance. And so they started talking to industry. They started floating the idea about, we'd like to take an existing aircraft that we could modify and make into the new trainer. And industry went back and forth. Well, you know, your requirements are such that it's going to be very challenging to do that in an environment with using an existing aircraft. We would have to make significant modifications to the aircraft, and that would affect schedule and all of that. So back and forth. And again, they had no budget. It wasn't even in the POM to get this trainer. But they kept going, and they did this for a few years. And I was helping one of the competitors who was chasing after this acquisition, who also happened to be the builder of the T-48 aircraft, or T-40, I'm getting maybe confused, 43, 48, one of those, the current one. Anyways, they made a decision. Eventually, the Air Force got some money, and they made a decision. They were going to build a clean sheet using digital engineering, a new aircraft. And so they invested $500 million of their own money before the release of the solicitation to develop a new aircraft. Now, that benefited the government in many ways. And it allowed the contractor to assess, okay, you know, if they're going to come out for something that already exists, maybe we're going to have it already existing before the solicitation comes out. And in fact, they did have a first flight before the contract was awarded, and the winner of that contract was Boeing, who was the supplier of the last trainer. And that's now known as, it was TX, it's now the T-7 aircraft. It's having some problems in development, but the fact that the industry responded, and I'm sure other companies made investment decisions, but I can speak the one I do know, what Boeing did. They saw this was essential to their company if they wanted to stay in this business space, and they invested to make that possible. And so that's the kind of responses you can get out of industry. And even on a smaller scale, if you issue a good draft RFP, industry starts working on their proposal as soon as they see the draft. And having not been on a proposal team till after I retired, government takes months and months to develop their RFP, and they expect the industry to turn a proposal in 30 days. Let me tell you, that's hard. You have to have something going before the solicitation, especially for a major procurement. And so, you know, sharing that time when we're on the insides doing around whatever RFP is going to be about, and sharing that time with industry, give them some time working on the proposal, that's a win-win. And if your listeners have not read these four Office of Federal Procurement Policy myth-busting memorandum, they are really excellent memorandums if you want to look at what are some good ways to have a dialogue with industry, not only pre-award, but also how we deal with them at the award decision in terms of debriefings. There's four of them out there issued between one February 2011 that was mostly on government misperception of what you can and can't do in early dialogue, and talked about myths of, like, you can't meet with contractors 101, or if we do, there'll be protest, or there's a risk of delay, or what are the value you get out of it, et cetera. It sets those things aside. The Myth-Busting 2 memo in July of 2012 addressed industry perceptions and concerns related to this early dialogue with government. And then the third one in January 2017 addressed mutual misperceptions and concerns regarding the whole process of debriefings. And the most recent, the now back in 2019, April 2019, addressed innovative business practices. And this is really helpful in terms of upping our game and the speed and getting through the government acquisition process. They talk about commercial solutions openings and OTs and other things that can help us move quickly that involve still a close working relationship with industry. And so I really encourage folks to read those memos, and particularly if they're working on a program or contract that's over $10 million, to make sure they're doing the right kind of engagement with industry, and really truly is a win-win for both government and industry.
All right. No, great, great stuff there, sir. And again, those four myth-busting memoranda. We'll put a note in the show notes on that to steer people that way. So
anyway, I have them on my website. That's another a gift for for your listeners today. Dayton Aerospace is my library, I call it, but we maintain a defense acquisition library. It has over 200 guides and reports, all kind of not regulatory things, but all guides and templates and reports and things that help acquisition teams figure out how to do some things. So they come from all different agencies. They're all government documents, so they're all public domain, but they're all over the place. I mean, I go to like 40 different websites to get these things, but I post them there at Dayton Aerospace, and you can go in and go to the Defense Acquisition Library. You don't have to put an email. You're anonymous. Nobody cares who you are. And you can download and search those guides and download a copy from right there. If they're digital, I provide a link rather than a copy of the guide. But all four of those myth-busting memos are on that website, and it's good stuff. But really, the topics there covers program management, product support, engineering, contracting, financial management, pricing, all those disciplines in the acquisition program office have resources available there for our clients and even those who aren't our clients. Sorry, that's off subject for a while, but I really am proud of the acquisition library we've created.
No, that's awesome, sir. We always love to post additional resources for the listeners out there. We'll be sure to highlight that in the show notes. So getting back, we were talking about the requirement. We're talking about the dialogue with industry, pre-solicitation, and that ongoing dialogue, right? Incredibly beneficial for both sides. And that kind of ties into your third principle that kind of hits home for anyone who's ever tried to interpret complex documents. So principle three is say exactly what you mean. Lack of clarity is an invitation for dispute. And I love this. Out of your article, you give some great examples of vague language that just a lot of us are in a really bad habit of using. Things like includes but is not limited to, or maybe primarily, or maybe as needed. Right. So what's the real world impact of such ambiguity? And what's one piece of advice you'd give to someone writing a statement of work to ensure definitive language?
Well, yeah, in exact terms, really disrupt the goal of having a meeting of the minds prior to agreeing on a contract, price, and delivery schedules. If the parties have different understandings, obviously that can lead to requests for equitable adjustments, claims, disputes, and worse, perhaps, cost and schedule growth. And, you know, this is sometimes complicated by this culture of risk-averse approach to acquisition in the government. And, you know, we want to set up a contract that will allow the government to meet demand even more than what was initially envisioned as part of the requirement. So we write something vague saying, well, then we can read it as being in there. And, you know, unfortunately, that does happen quite often, and further complicated by turnover of government and acquisition teams as regional program manager or contracting officer moves on or new people take their positions. And, you know, they weren't there when the language was written. And so they may maybe try to read today's current environment into it. And it's obviously a huge risk for industry, right? I mean, especially on a fixed price contract. I mean, we've got to be able on the industry side of the table, look at what you're trying to achieve, understand it, have a credible plan of what we're going to do to deliver that requirement, and then we can estimate the cost or price of performing that work. If it's vague or ambiguous, we're caught between this bid a lot of risk in case it's there, and wait, it's competitive, I got to bid as low as I can. And so we're caught in this dynamic. And, you know, competition, that's another one coming up, is very powerful. And so it's a huge incentive for contractors to not fully bid the risk. And then we end up with these difficult contract relationships. I mean, when you're in disagreement over what the contract requires, it is not a healthy business relationship for either side to try to deal with each other.
Right, sir. And then ambiguity usually almost always goes against the author of the document, correct?
Yeah, that's a general rule, but, you can't bet on it. I mean, ambiguity is in the eye of the beholder, too. You have to convince the boarders or court that it was indeed ambiguous. And they don't know acquisition. I mean, obviously the Boards of Contract Appeals do, but the Court of Federal Claims doesn't. And so it's not something you can count on from my perspective in an industry seat anyways.
All right. So no, great, great point on that. So ideally, once we have this clear statement of work in hand, right, we still need to understand the inherent risks, as you mentioned, which brings us to principle number four. Principle number four states, risks are assessed before award, they're accommodated by the award, and they're managed after award. Can you share an example of how a contracting team effectively accommodated maybe a high-rated risk within a contract before award, and how that paid off during the execution of the contract?
So I think this is one of my favorite risk stories, actually, is how the acquisition community responded to improvised explosive devices in Iraq and Afghanistan. Actually, I co-wrote a book with another Dayton Aerospace employee, Bill Stockman, Dr. Bill Stockman, about what do we call that thing? Competitive strategies for systems acquisition and lifecycle management. And we originally developed it under a contract for OUSD, under Secretary of Defense, to update a guide they had that said, how do you create and sustain competition in a systems acquisition program? And so we do case studies in the book. And one of the ones that I really liked was a study of the mine-resistant, ambush-protected MRAP vehicles that were produced by the Marine Corps back in the early 2000s. You know, as your listeners probably know, I mean, we were dominant when it came to air in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, we controlled the skies, but we couldn't control the ground. And so those soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who had to travel on the ground were at great risk from these IEDs planted along the roadsides. And so, you know, the particularly the Army and the Marine Corps really invested a lot of energy in trying to find innovative methods to detect and remotely detonate devices like that. And that required them to issue a lot of concurrent research proposals and do some quick evaluations to quickly identify and field some capabilities. But the secure transport was a bigger problem. We needed a lot of vehicles. Initially, when we started this MRAP program, it was really only used for route clearing and, you know, kind of the first in kind of situation. But it turned out that they were so effective that we needed more of them. So the Marine Corps kicked off a real major acquisition program, and they had three goals. We had to field survival mission-capable vehicles, obviously. We needed to field them as quickly as possible, and we wanted to grow the industrial base capabilities at the same time. And so they initially awarded phase one contracts to 10 contractors, where the contractors provided prototypes, which were tested by the Marine Corps. After going through the testing process, the Marine Corps awarded 5 production contracts that were treated the vehicles as commercial items. In fact, they were even in the prototype. And so they were able to award these on a firm fixed price basis. By awarding 5 contracts, they had the opportunity to place orders with competition between the contractors. And it turned out that that was good not only for fielding capability quickly, because obviously 5 vendors could make a lot more MRAPs than one could in a short period of time. The demand continued to grow. And so all the vendors were really cranking out vehicles to the field. Now, of course, there was a trade-off there. They focused on speed and getting capability out quickly. But you can imagine, Rob, what they didn't focus on that became a problem later. Sustainment. And so, you know, they needed to then adjust, right? So they gradually over time introduced some things to put in a little more commonality in things like engines and tires and transmissions. But they didn't have a lot of data on these commercial vehicles in terms of maintaining for them. And because they had 5 different configurations, the sustainment tail was long. So through the management of the program, they kept identifying how they might be able to mitigate that risk and took some actions. But ultimately, they dealt with a very complex sustainment program because their priority was fielding capability quick. And I would argue that was the right position, but there's trade-offs. So you mitigate one risk, and you maybe increase another risk. But in the end, they ended up, it was too expensive to transport all these vehicles back home anyway. So they left a lot of broken blew up some of these vehicles when we left Iraq and Afghanistan. So that was an effective risk strategy, but you can see sometimes you address one critical risk and it impacts another risk. So there's a play, there's some trade-offs involved sometimes.
No, absolutely, sir. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that proactive risk management clearly saves a lot of headaches down the line. But as you mentioned, a lot of times there's trade-offs, right? There might be another risk that you didn't consider, or maybe you did consider it and just decided, hey, this is the business decision. We're going to take that risk. And a key element in managing that risk is ensuring best value in competition, which leads to your fifth principle. So principle number 5, all potential offerers should be provided a fair opportunity to compete and be considered for award. So today's competition environment, a little bit different than when you first wrote these principles back in 1995, right? We got the rise of the broad-based IDIQ contracts, other transaction consortia, other overarching acquisition approaches, all goodness in my mind. But what are the biggest trade-offs you see with these modern competitive strategies? And how can contracting officers ensure fair competition within them?
Yeah, great question, because certainly that has changed. The rise of multiple award IDIQ is just stunning in that, you know, there are contracts out there that have over 100 contractors on it. So it's like a whole different market out there that is established just for a particular scope of work that's involved in that multiple award IDIQ contract. The challenge to industry on that is you could win a contract and never win an order. You could spend a lot of money submitting fair opportunity proposal responses and not win an order. And then those were growing and increasing in frequency. And I was at a briefing somewhere where the government briefed that they were upset with the contractors because they weren't submitting proposals. And it's like, well, you kind of set that up. But on the other side of it, I'm helping the client right now with a program like that. And what I like about it is we're going to have a large range of contractors on there. And we know that not all of these contractors can do all the work, and we're okay with that. So we're saying that we're going to, consider your responsiveness, but if you're not going to submit a proposal, just tell us why, and that it won't be counted against you. So, we still want to be engaged, but we recognize, we deliberately made this contract broad. And so if you have a particular niche within this portfolio, we want you to be able to play and participate, be part of the contractor team, but we don't want to have to say you got to respond to everything. And we want to have enough people there that we have enough for different kinds of suppliers who can respond to different things, that we get enough competition. Frankly, it would be a nightmare if we received... I'm sorry. I still say we, Rob. You know that about me when I talk about the government. I've been out. I've been out for 13 years. I can't do that. But we really don't want 150 proposals for orders to come in. So that's the challenge. It's for industry. It's a cost of submitting proposals. They're not going to win. So of course they're going to focus on the ones they think they have the best chance to win. The other one that's a real big change is the OTs. And, the CECA, Competition and Contracting Act, full and open competition doesn't apply to OTs because they're non-FAR-based instruments. And however, the regulations for OTs still says that, you shall have... maximum practicable. I can't remember what the exact words are, but there's a competition requirement for OTs. And what I like about the OTs, most small businesses are not geared for government contracting. And small business, another principle I'll talk about later, but they're geared to commercial customers. And if they are able to compete on an OT that doesn't burden them with a lot of specific and unique government requirements, they may be able to respond and provide innovative solutions to the government. So I see the OTs as a really valuable tool, especially reaching those non-traditional and small business suppliers. So competition is good. Both industry and government like competition. We like to be able to show, we've got the best. You'll pick us and you'll be happy. And of course, from the government perspective, knowing that you've got, a fair market value because of the market is telling you what a competitive price is, that makes awards so much quicker and easier to accomplish. I remember one time one of my program officers insisted that it was had to be a sole source requirement. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, they've done it for so long. They're the only ones who could do it. I said, well, have you done market research? No. Well, if they are the only ones who can do it, that will be proven out by a competitive acquisition. So let's go ahead and go competitive. And we can do it faster than we can sole source. And that they didn't believe me at the time, but we did it competitive. We did have competition and we did it faster than we would have done a, truth and price, certified cost and pricing data negotiation to award the contract. So competition's good.
Another great point, sir. Yeah, I love it. Balancing efficiency with opportunity. Great stuff there. And so maybe in those hopefully rare instances where competition may lead to a protest, your next principle comes into play. Principle number 6, we lose protests if we do not do as we say or do as directed. So you identified in your article, again, going back a few years ago, according to GAO statistics, only a small percentage of protests are actually sustained. But the reasons for those sustained protests are telling, such as unreasonable tech avowals or maybe a flawed solicitation. So from your experience, what's the most common mistake an agency makes that may lead to a sustained protest? And what's the simplest way for a contracting officer to avoid that?
I have to give you two, because from my perspective, there are two. And telling you what they are tells you how to fix them. The first one is source selection criteria that's too complicated, has too many things in it. You know, if we can keep our source selection criteria limited to key discriminators, we can go quickly and we can really sort out the wheat from the chaff in the source selection. We don't have to evaluate everything. We don't have to make an evaluation factor. The contractor still has to be compliant with the solicitation. So non-compliances are still assessed, but they're not source selection evaluation criteria. So streamlined source selection is the first one. Keep it simple. It's easier to defend your decision when you do, and it's easier to make a good choice quickly. And the last one is document, document, document. If it isn't written, it didn't happen. And so often we go to a source selection and, or go to a protest and something gets challenged and we go in and say, well, this was our intent when we made that decision. Is it documented? Well, we've written it down now. Well, you know, the general rule is a contemporaneous document prepared at the time of a decision or action will have much more weight than something we are now trying to argue before a court or board that we developed from memory because we know that's what we did. And so those two things, I think, would really eliminate. Well, you can never eliminate a protest. I mean, they're going to come no matter what. But if you write good, clear criteria and you use it in your source selection and you provide clear feedback to the offerors, either in when you're doing your discussions, if you are discussing, or when you're doing your debriefing, so they know what was evaluated, how it was evaluated, and it's all documented. You get, even if you get a protest, you're going to win it. It's not worth losing sleep over. Move fast. I don't like the phrase move fast and break things, but when it comes to protests, that's how I feel.
No, great stuff, sir. Again, key takeaways there. Keep it simple, keep it clear, keep it documented, right? All good advice we learned throughout the years. So great stuff. So now let's shift gears a little bit to a principle that's not just about process, but about broader economic impact. And you alluded to this one a little bit earlier. So principle number 7, small business is good for America. Small disadvantaged businesses are even better. So you link this principle to innovation, job creation, and economic development. In our era of strategic sourcing leading to maybe fewer but larger contracts, how can our contracting professionals still find ways to truly leverage federal spending to strengthening maybe those disadvantaged communities rather than just setting goals?
Yeah, this is a tough one in a time where we're challenging such things as affirmative action and whatnot. But the bottom line is there are over 34 million small businesses in America, and there's only about 20,000 large and medium-sized businesses nationally. So most of the businesses in America are small. Now, granted, a lot of them, restaurants, hair salons, they don't care about government contracting, but you know, there are many, many small businesses out there that have unique and innovative technologies. I mean, usually when someone starts a small business, it's because they got a good idea. You know, they come up with a good idea and they get it out there and market it and start getting traction. And, you know, look back at the history of the small businesses that got started in America, like Facebook, now Meta, like Google, now Alphabet, like Hewlett-Packard. I'm not even sure who owns them now. There were so many of these companies that started in a dorm room or a garage with a good idea. Even Amazon, right? Another one that started small and got big. And so, you know, if we're not looking for those small businesses, we miss those opportunities. Now, granted, there's only so many manufacturers in the United States who can make fighter aircraft. in even cargo aircraft. Some things are just so capitally intensive that there aren't many small business opportunities there. And that's why we have small business subcontracting plans out there to help ensure that they, these larger or medium-sized businesses, engage the support and small businesses in the role that they can deliver value. But I wouldn't, I don't know what's going to happen to the various categories of small businesses over the next couple of years. But I really do think there is great value in these unique categories of small businesses. You know, when you're selecting a hub zone small business, for example, you're potentially bringing jobs to a part of America that needs that work. And that's good for the country. And if we're going to be spending public money, we ought to be doing good for the country where we can. And of course, Dayton Aerospace is a service-disabled small veteran-owned small business, recently transitioned from a just veteran-owned small business. And those are good as well because, hey, we're supporting veterans who serve their country. And in many cases, there are disabled veterans out there due to their service in the military. And so, again, good stuff from the perspective of society. But the real key here is small businesses are the engine that powers the United States economy. And that's why FAR Part 19 matters. Every contracting officer, a contract specialist that works for the government, in my mind, must be an advocate for small businesses and must look for opportunities to purchase from small businesses when they can. And it's another one of those win-win, you know, innovation and, frankly, price. Small businesses usually have low overhead and are going to give you a much lower price than a large business would. And you're going to be much more likely to have competition if you're dealing with small businesses. So some of these, you can see how all these things are kind of interrelated, but it's why they continue to endure in our acquisition business.
No, absolutely, sir. Yeah, plenty of benefits there. Absolutely. And it's just a powerful and practical way to look at federal spending, right? It's an economic development tool. So awesome stuff. And your next principle emphasizes one of the fundamental rules of funding, right? Principle number 8, you must obligate funds to order work, and you must order work to obligate funds. So the first part of that principle, obligating funds, hopefully is well understood. But that second part, you must order work to obligate funds, may be less obvious. Can you elaborate on why that second part is so critical? Maybe perhaps share a common scenario where COs get in trouble by obligating funds without a corresponding obligation for the contractor to perform work. I know you've got a story on this one with the legal review, right?
Yeah, I do. Just to prove that I'm not the smartest contracting officer out there. I was working the one and only firm fixed incentive firm price contract that I had administered in my contracting career. And it had gone long, dragged on, and the contract expanded and expanded. The contractor was way behind schedule. They were already $300 million over the ceiling price of the contract. So it was we were in a tough place. We had reserve funding to fund the target to ceiling gap on the contract, which would essentially then allow the contractor to bill against it. And we were not happy with the contractor's performance at the time. And so we kind of looked at ways to maybe do that differently. And we thought, well, we could obligate it, but not increase the contract prices so they can't bill against it. And I sent that mod up to legal for review, and they said, you can't do that. The obligation with funding is mutual. If you obligate funding, the contractor then is obligated to perform. And so if you try to obligate funding where there's no obligation to perform, it's an illegal obligation. I'm like, oh. So, you know, there are other times that happens, like you got a ward fee pool that you want to save that the contractor has earned yet, but the money's expiring. So you try to park it on a contract somewhere. Yeah, just it's obligated in reserve. Nope, won't work. You know, maybe you get by if you don't get a legal review, but it's good to know what's legal before you try to do it. Also, cost overruns. You know, when you obligate a cost overrun, the contractor is immediately able to invoice against that. It becomes part of the contract price at that point in time. So you're going to put money on contract. The contractor is going to be able to invoice and get payment on that money you're putting on contract. They may have to do something to do it, but they're going to be able to invoice against it. So it's a good kind of lesser known thing to know when it comes to funding. And don't ever, ever award a contract without enough money. That one can get you in jail. Okay.
No, great. So yeah, that second part, it's interesting stuff, right? And I think, I don't know, in my mind, I think that's a great CO board question, maybe. Again, great scenario you laid out, right? There's good reasons for it. Hey, we were just going to park the money. It doesn't work that way. So great point there. And again, crucial distinction, one that can save serious implications. So along with obligating funds, we also need to ensure everyone's getting a fair deal. And that brings us to your principle number 9. Principle number 9 states the contracting officer must always determine the price to be fair and reasonable. So you describe pricing as more art than science and share a fascinating personal story about an aircraft component where you had no basis to determine that the proposed price was not fair and reasonable. So a little creative language there, but what's the biggest challenge a contracting officer faces in making that fair and reasonable determination, especially when data is scarce or the item is unique?
You know, it's not so much that, it's price analysis. Price analysis is hard. You know, it cost analysis, you got all this data, you can place all this reliance on it because it's, you know, certified, assuming you're over 2 million, it's certified to be current, accurate, and complete. And so you can get fooled by that too, though. I like my Joe's Garage scenario. You could hire Joe's Garage to build you a Chevy Impala, and they could order all the parts and build an Impala, and it cost you about $3 million. But, you know, that obviously wouldn't be reasonable from a price analysis perspective. So cost analysis can lead you down a path, which is why you have to do price analysis when you are doing cost analysis as well, to make sure that what you added it all up to is in fact reasonable from a total price perspective. By the way, they don't make the Chevy Impala anymore, so you couldn't get off the production line. But, but it's possible that Joe's Garage could build one if they could find all the parts. But price analysis is what's hard. I think it's harder than cost analysis. And when do we do price analysis? Commercial item pricing, or we call it commercial products and services now. Sorry for my old school language there. But so if you're buying something commercial, it can be non-competitive. So if you have a non-competitive commercial buy and you're trying to conduct price analysis to determine that the price is fair and reasonable, you've got to go to some extremes, right? Or at least find, we're supposed to minimize what we ask for from the contractor in a commercial environment. So maybe we ask for a history of sales. Can you show me that you sold it to non-government customers at a similar price with similar terms and conditions, you know, that sort of thing. So I think price analysis is in many ways harder than cost analysis and requires a degree of creativity and art in terms of determining what is a fair and reasonable price. And I did another NCMA article about it. Actually, they made it the cover story, which was really cool. They had a big art splash of paint on the cover page and called, what did they call it? Let me see. Price analysis, the rules and the art, contract management, November 2020, if you have the old magazine around. But I wrote about this topic about how challenging price analysis can be to deal with. My determination that I had no basis to determine the price was not fair and reasonable. I was trying to get a waiver from cost and pricing data, and there was no way the contracting agency was going to give me that waiver until I found the price to be fair and reasonable. So I'd had to find an acceptable method using price analysis to say that in order to get the waiver. So that took me a while to get through that process and figure out how I could determine that these militarized commercial computers were indeed priced in a fair and reasonable way. This was pre-FAR Part 12, so I didn't have quite as much flexibility as we have today. But yeah. That was fun.
All right, great, sir. No, pricing, yeah, definitely a challenging but essential part of the job for sure. So moving on to another fundamental aspect of contract performance leads us into your principle number 10, which states the government should receive what it pays for, pay for what it receives, and not receive that for which it has not paid. So you caution against the government trying to get something for free, referencing the Anti-Deficiency Act, the prohibition on voluntary services. So can you explain the underlying risk that the Anti-Deficiency Act aims to prevent when an organization accepts products or services at no charge, even if it's well-intentioned, right? What are the potential negative consequences down the line there?
So, yeah, the real challenge is that, you know, there's not a true agreement. And, you know, you have something where the company sends something in because you said you needed it, and they say it's going to be free, and then their side invoices, and now I got a ratification going on or something like that. And so as a general rule, though, things have value, and contract is a trade-off of value, right? You give me product, I give you money, and we've had a true mutual consideration. However, we do have some opportunities now with non-FAR-based things that may have tweaked at, or maybe whittled away at this principle after 30 years. And that is using OTs where the company is putting in some of the money, right, by providing a product, and the government is providing an evaluation of that product to the company as a return to benefit them. And so we have a mutual consideration under an OT that's a no-cost contract. And so I've seen that actually used. The organization that Tradewinds. Tradewinds organizations has done that sort of thing. It's a DoD organization that really tries to leverage innovation and new technology. And so they've done this thing where, you know, you submit provide a product on an OT, we evaluate the product and give you feedback. And then in doing that, then we understand what the products have to offer. And so we do this with multiple contractors. Then we issue another OT to buy them and allow those contractors to compete. And now we know we're not just depending on what the contractor says it does. We're depending on our evaluation when we make the award decision. So it kind of is something for free, but it's not, because there's government work involved that is fed back to the contractor in the process. But as a general rule, we should expect to pay for what we receive. And where I first encountered this, I was buying spare parts at Hill Air Force Base. And I called this company and I said I needed like 12 screws or something for some military piece of equipment. And the company said, it's going to cost me more to package and ship you those and go through the invoice process. Can I just give them to you? And I checked it out and I had to come back and says, no, I'm sorry, you can't get my dress.
Yeah. And again, you know, sometimes, you know, very well intentioned, right?
Exactly.
Great clarification there. That term free often comes with hidden costs or risks. And speaking of what's real in a contract, your 11th principle is absolutely foundational. Principle 11 talks about the contract is the only real agreement, and only the contracting officer may change that agreement. So you highlight the dangers here of informally managing a business relationship, especially when it leads to those constructive changes, right, which you describe as difficult and contentious to resolve. Can you give us an example of a constructive change and why they're so problematic and expensive for the government to settle?
Well, that big fixed price incentive firm contract with the $300 million overrun, the program office had been constructively changing that contract for years by little agreements at program management reviews. Okay, well, don't do it that way, do it this way. And and so it was, it kind of incrementally just creeped and changed. And then the really came to a head when they completely, we wanted to try to recover schedules, so we completely changed the test program informally. and allowed them to proceed with tests before they had finished development, and created all sorts of other additional problems. This is what caused the risk and the cost to grow so much. And so the lesson I would caution any contracting officer about, if you are ever in a meeting and you hear something that sounds like a change, immediately, of course, hopefully you have a clause in your contract that requires the contractor to confirm whether it's a change by notifying the government, but immediately take action to either confirm or deny the change. And if the change is confirmed, take action to modify the contract to implement the change so that we know the cost and schedule impact of the change before it proceeds. That's the real risk with these constructive changes, is things happen, again, all well-intentioned, trying to recover, you know, something that's overrunning or behind schedule. And so we say, well, what if we do it this way different instead? And then going down that path ends in problems later and causes more schedule and cost growth. Well, whose fault is that? Well, it's our fault for losing control of our contract. And so we really need to, make sure that the contractor's doing what the contract says, and make sure that everybody on the government teams is holding the contractor accountable for the contract requirements. And if they change, then let's change them. Let's do it bilaterally and make sure we all know, or we can even do a unilateral change order if appropriate. But let's just keep the contract so it's a true reflection of what we're working on, especially these contracts that run a long period of time. That's where it happens really often and can be very, very difficult to resolve.
Yes, sir. No, absolutely. And that ties into all your other points as well, right? Keep it clear, it documented, keep it simple, right? They say good fences mm-hmm. make good neighbors. Good contracting terms might make a good relationship there.
Right. Yeah. Good partners. Those are my words. I'd say good partners.
All right. So that underscores, a critical role there of the contracting officer maintaining contract integrity. And then finally, your last principle brings us back to a powerful motivator. Principle number 12, follow the money. It really does make the contract work. So you state that money is the most powerful incentive for contract performance. How does a contracting officer's strategic choice of contract type, financing arrangement, or even an award fee plan directly impact a contractor's motivation and performance? Can you maybe give us an example of a common mistake in this area and the potential consequences?
Well, I think there's a tension. Well, obviously, firm fixed price is the best, right? I mean, a firm fixed price contract, the contractor knows if they can reduce their cost and still meet your requirements, they're going to make more profit than envisioned. Wonderful. Good win-win for them. And, if it was a competitive environment, even better, right? We know we had a good price and the contractor got the job done for less money. God bless America, right? That's what we want. When you get into these other kinds of contracts, it's important to consider those incentives. And even if you have a fixed price contract, if you're using some sort of performance-based billing, we want to make sure that we don't front load the funding too much. And I think that's a common mistake. The contractor's always going to want to say, give me more money up front than, that'll keep my cash flow going. And frankly, government financing is about the best available in the industry, but it is based many times on cost incurred. Progress payments based on cost incurred is just not going to work for a small business because most of them don't have government cost accounting systems that would allow them to appropriately invoice under that arrangement. And so we end up then with some sort of payment schedule, and there are, commercial ways to approach that does even allow advance payments. But I just caution contracting officers of getting too much money up front because it may not drive the incentive for completion. Because, if they've already got a lot of the money and there's only a little bit left, there's not as much pressure to get it done. Now, obviously, they want to meet the schedule so you don't default them for failure to perform. But how you spread the money is important. And, the amount of money you make as incentives is important. I was the terminating contracting officer on a program that was for a Saudi air defense system. And contractor was terminated because they were late, behind schedule, over cost and all that. And the Saudi said, look, we need this system. And so we We went out and we awarded a follow or a new contract, and we put a huge delivery incentive. The contractor had the opportunity to get a $20 million delivery incentive if they delivered ahead of schedule. And that $20 million was spread out by month. So 20 months early, 20 million, 19 months early, 19 million. You know, it was huge. So it was a big, big incentive, and it really paid off and got the work done. Now, we don't always have that kind of money to play with. The Saudis have some oil money. They could do it. But, you know, the incentive has to be meaningful to really be effective. And so if you're going to have an award pool, fee pool, and it's so small, it may not be worth the burden and the administrative effort to manage an award fee contract. So, yeah, I will qualify this a little bit. Industry is not only motivated by money. No contractor wants to take your contract and not deliver. Right. They want to have satisfied customers. So industry is very motivated by customer satisfaction. They want to meet your needs. And many people out here in industry are patriots. They know what they're doing, especially when it's national defense, is important. And they know it's important to the warfighter. So they want to get it done. They want to be on schedule. They want to be on cost. They don't want to shortchange the government. And so, you know, sometimes we get a negative perception of industry. It's all about the money. And yeah, it's important. But recognize that satisfied customers are equally important to the money.
No, great, great point, sir. Absolutely. So we have covered a lot of ground today. Right, from the fundamental importance of requirements to the power of incentives, your 12 enduring principles truly offer timeless wisdom, right, for anyone navigating the complexities of government contracting. So I would say these principles have certainly endured throughout government acquisition since you first penned them about 30 years ago. And looking back with some of the challenges and turbulence since we've faced since then, right? Have you thought about adding an addendum or maybe a few more principles, or is there something specific you wish you would have caught early on?
You know, looking back,
did you just nail it?
First in 1995, and then I did an NCMA speaking event at Boston Chapter NCMA in 2001, and I thought, dang, that was pretty good. And then I happened to come across that as I was looking through some old papers in 2000, and I ended up writing the article for NCMA in 2021, 20 years later. And then here you are now 30 years later, and they still seem to be pretty good. I mean, I maybe could come up with another one, but I think it really covers the range. And I don't know that if you're not an NCMA member that you'll be able to get my article from May 2021, but I will put it on the Dayton Aerospace website in our acquisition library so you can find it there.
All right, sir. Excellent. And again, thanks so much for sharing your experiences and insights on The Contracting Experience and walking us through your 12 enduring principles for contracting professionals, right? Great conversation, lessons for everyone, government, industry, anyone in that acquisition space. So grateful you could join us today. So on behalf of The Contracting Experience podcast, all of our listeners and subscribers, thank you so much again. It has been a pleasure having you. Do you have any parting shots or other words of wisdom for our podcast listeners today?
For those of you who heard my Good Enough for Government podcast, thank you for your service to the American country or the world. Public service is a noble calling, and I am federal employees' biggest fan. I have a bumper sticker on the back of my truck that says, thank you, federal employees, public service is a noble calling. And you have hard work in the acquisition business. It's not easy. It's complicated. It's demanding. And I know how hard you work. And so I thank you for your service. And next time I see one of you, I will thank you again, because I cannot thank you all enough.
All right. Thanks, sir. And yeah, for those listeners who may have missed Mr. Wells' first episode on The Contracting Experience, I'd invite you to check out episode number 58, where he talks about his phrase, good enough for government work. Again, another great episode. I think we're maybe 2,000 downloads on that one. Again, really good response on that one, sir. So, and as always, a huge thanks to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. And as a reminder, you can subscribe to the Contracting Experience podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.